speak at an annual conference that Hofstra College has on the presidency. They've really done quite a remarkable job in bringing people together every year to look at particular presidents. And our speaker today was the principal speaker, the paper giver, on the First Lady in the Ford administration. And now they will be discussing in November the Carter presidency, and once again she's involved in the program in that regard. So her credentials are beyond debate, I think, in this area that we've been exploring. We're also very pleased that, in addition to Dr. Myra Guten, that Mrs. Lillian Greenberg, her mother, could be with us today. Myra Guten was born in Paterson, New Jersey, received her bachelor's and master's degree from Emerson College and her PhD from the University of Michigan. She is an associate professor of communications at Ryder College, which, in case you are not fully informed, is the institution that has lent fame and prestige to that lesser-known institution, Princeton. She's taught for over 20 years and published widely, but her best-known book is the book President's Partner. She has worked in preparing her books and her studies in all the major presidential libraries around the country, as well as the National Archives and the Smithsonian. She's had research support for this project, and this past January, she managed to do what all of us would like to do on our topics of interest, managed to get the students at Ryder College to sit still for an entire month to study the topic of First Ladies, which I think testifies to her mastery and control of the subject matter. So we're very pleased that after one or two false starts, well, we finally worked out a date, and Dr. Guten is joining us today.
Thank you. I've spent a number of years researching this topic, and I must tell you, just once, I'd like to read the following want ad, and it would go a little something like this. Wanted, woman, 45 to 60 years of age. College education desirable, but not necessary. Well-dressed, good management skills a necessity. Responsibilities include chairing national project, planning state dinners, discrete political activities. Should be able to deal with the media and unending criticism. Cute children an asset. Position includes housing in prestige location, large staff, 18 to 22 people, extensive travel. Salary, none. Job description, none. Selection for position, applicants need be selected by only one man. Rewards, your place in history. Just once, I'd like to see that. I began to research the communication activities of the First Lady in 1977, and it has been an ongoing interest for me. It culminated last year in the publication of my book, and I'd like to share both some of my scholarly findings and also some of the anecdotes that I was able to pick up along the way. I also want to pay tribute to my mother, who is with me this afternoon, because I always tease her and say that I was raised at the Eleanor Roosevelt Shrine, for better or worse, and that at least initially sparked my interest. My field is communication, as Mr. Thompson mentioned, and because of that, I decided that I was going to focus on speeches, press relations, in other words, all of the activities that a woman might engage in translating her interest in a topic or advocacy for a project into some kind of meaningful way to approach the public. I found during my research that the women of the 20th century, and I also have to add a little sidestep here, I began my research in 1920 because I thought it made sense to begin with the first ladies who occupied the White House after suffrage. Those first ladies after 1920 seem to fall into three rather discrete categories. The first one I called ceremonial presences, and please don't throw eggs, the White House keepers. Okay, I know it's a bad title. A second category I called the emerging spokeswomen, and last but not least, political advocates and independent presences. Let me now go through the women that I placed in each of those categories, the reasons why they were there, and perhaps a few things about each. The first category that I developed, I called, as I said, the White House keepers, the women who were basically ceremonial presences, whose main raison d'etre for being in the White House was to entertain. I don't think that it's ever fair to say that a woman is totally inactive in the White House. There really is no such thing. But some had more limited activities than others, and certainly this group would be part of that. The first lady that I would put into this group was Florence Harding. I'm not exactly sure what you know about her. She certainly would qualify as quite a character. This was the woman who invited a clairvoyant into the White House. She is the woman that we can blame the Easter egg roll down the White House lawn on, and was also, to my knowledge, the first lady to go and visit wounded soldiers at Walter Reed Hospital. Now, she wasn't active in any kind of a public way, but in the years that have passed, and since we've had some access to what was left of the Harding letters, we've learned that she was most active in private, that she did try to influence her husband's decision-making whenever possible. Now, he, for his part, gave her the chance to make certain decisions. One of my favorites is that he decided that he would let her decide which convicts in federal penitentiaries could be pardoned. And she did make those decisions. Now, she tried to talk him out of proposing, he had decided to propose a 1 6-year term of office for the president. And she said, you can't do that because it really is a confession of weakness. And she was able to talk him out of that. It was also because of Mrs. Harding that we had no residence for the vice president until the time the Rockefellers moved into the Naval Observatory. And it was because there was a bill that was coming up in Congress which would have made a stately home in Washington the residence for the Coolidges, who at that point were the vice presidential couple. Mrs. Harding hated Grace Coolidge, and she said, I'm going to have that bill defeated. It's going to be defeated. A hotel apartment is good enough for those Coolidges, and we're not sure exactly what extent she did have in that decision, how responsible she was, but the bill was defeated, and that was the end of the residence for the vice president. So certainly she was a relatively inactive first lady, though she was well-liked by the public. She was followed into the White House by a woman who couldn't have been any different had she tried, and that was Grace Coolidge. Mrs. Coolidge, of course, the wife of the vice president, she probably would have been a much more active, involved first lady had she come to the White House under different circumstances. She came in on the heels of the Teapot Dome scandal, and her husband said to her and the rest of his official family, we have to restore dignity to government. And for you, Grace, this means you will not smoke in public, you will not dance. He would not permit her to fly in airplanes. He didn't want her to do anything. But the most damning thing that he did, as far as I'm concerned, and those of us who do research in the First Ladies are concerned, is he said, you cannot be interviewed, you cannot be quoted. So there was no chance to get to know the First Lady. Let me tell you just how far poor reporters wanted to go in order to try to gain access to poor Mrs. Coolidge. One morning, she decided to break away. She went to the White House stables that I think were in Rock Creek Park at that time, and she got on the horse. She went for a little ride, and it really wasn't that newsworthy an event, but because she was never observed or rarely observed in places and certainly never quoted or anything, her picture was on page one of almost every newspaper the morning after this ride. And the story goes that Mr. Coolidge came into the living quarters of the White House, threw down the newspaper, and said, Grace, I think you will find that you will succeed in this job just as well as if you try nothing new. And I don't know, I think perhaps perhaps another interesting way to sum it up was years after they left the White House, Mrs. Coolidge was writing a series of articles for Good Housekeeping. And she wrote and she said, Mr. Coolidge and I never discussed politics. We never discussed current events. We never discussed religion. We never discussed blah, blah, blah. And she went on and on. And as I was doing my work for the book, my editor wrote back to me, my God, what did they discuss? I always thought that was a good comment as well. That I would put into this less active category is probably the most active, inactive first lady of the 20th century, and that was Bess Truman. The independent lady of independence was not happy being in the public spotlight. She too, like a number of her predecessors and those who came after her, was somewhat uncomfortable being in the glare of the public. But she cut herself off as much as possible. Now, I want to give you a fascinating yardstick to tell you just how much she did cut herself off. As I was working on the book, I went to the Reader's Guide to Periodical Literature. I tallied up the number of articles that had been written during Mrs. Truman's tenure in the White House, and it's 15 articles. That was for 7 years. Mrs. Eisenhower, who is probably the next least active first lady, had 43 written about her. So Mrs. Truman was not making herself available and certainly tried to stay out of the spotlight. Now, much like Mrs. Harding, however, we know that she had a great impact on presidential decision-making. 1,300 letters were opened. They were found up in the attic of 219 North Delaware Street when Mrs. Truman died at the age of 97. They were correspondence from Mr. Truman, written to Mrs. Truman during the summers when she would return to Independence to spend the summer months there with Margaret. I have to tell you, I've always been glad that they escaped Mrs. Truman's attention. Perhaps you're familiar with the story that she had destroyed her husband's love letters to her. In 1955, Mr. Truman had come across Mrs. Truman burning his letters, and he said, Bess, what are you doing? And she said, I'm burning your letters. And he said, why are you doing that? Think of history. And she turned to him and said, Harry, I have. I'm very glad those 1,300 were just found by accident. What I find fascinating about them, and I've read many of them, I can't lay claim to all of them, but many of them, is that he was essentially sharing state secrets with her. And I've always, one of the projects for sometime down the road is, I'd love to check the dates of the letters and see when the developments actually took place, because I can tell you that he was really sharing things with her that were not available to the public. We know that she advised him. We don't know to what extent, but we know that her counsel was sought out by the president. I had the privilege of spending some time with Betty Ford as I readied my book, and she said to me, everybody knew that Mrs. Truman was advising the president, and everybody knew he listened. So it was an interesting comment. The last of my first ladies in this initial category was Mamie Eisenhower. Mrs. Eisenhower was an Army wife, first, last, and always. By the time she had arrived at the White House, I think she had made homes for her family in better than 20 different locations all over the globe. And she was very glad to finally be in one place. Just one cute little sidelight on Mrs. Eisenhower. She is a very petite lady, as you might know. She's just a little bit. She was just a little bit under 5 feet, and she knew that when she arrived at the White House, she was going to be welcoming many people to the Executive Mansion and shaking hands. And she said to the chief usher, J.B. West, "I never want to have to look up at anyone again." So they built her a podium to stand on, and it's about this high. And she stood on it, and for all those years, and they were fond of saying this, Mamie Eisenhower looked down on everyone as they went by. She was feminine almost to the point of frivolity, but she was accepted in the era of the 50s. She probably had less to do with presidential decision-making than any of the first ladies, except for one fascinating area. We know that she had input into, of all things, the federal budget. President Eisenhower used to say that, well, Mamie handled the checkbook, so he'd take home the budget to her for her to look at. And I've always had this idea, you know, the federal budget in those days was perhaps this thick, and I don't know, I wonder if George brings it home to Barbara, that's all I think about. At any rate, she really did feel that her role was to be wife and sustainer. She said, Ike fights the wars, I turn the lamb chops. And really, they kept their particular spheres of influence separately. Moving on to a second group. I called this group of women the emerging spokeswomen. And I found that these women were beginning to understand what the podium of the White House was and what could be done with it. They began to make use of the media, more speeches, more use of the press, and the beginning of an interest in a national project. The first woman I've placed in this group is Lou Henry Hoover. Mrs. Hoover was a fascinating woman. In many respects, she was a graduate of Stanford University with a degree in geology. And shortly after graduating, she married Herbert Hoover and moved to China. And thus began a fascinating partnership, because whatever Mr. Hoover did, Mrs. Hoover had a role in it. When they moved to China, they had the bad or good luck to be there during the Boxer Rebellion. Mr. Hoover supervised the building of a barricade around the foreign settlement where they were living. Mrs. Hoover organized a hospital. Many years later, they were in London as World War I broke out. Mr. Hoover was in charge of setting up a credit agency which made funds which had been frozen available to many of the people who were trapped in Europe at the beginning of World War I. Mrs. Hoover organized sightseeing, hotel rooms, meals, etc., etc. And this partnership followed them right into the White House. But Mrs. Hoover decided when she arrived in the White House, she didn't want to see the press. She didn't want to be quoted. But as quiet as she might have been publicly, that is almost a measure of how active she was privately. She was the national president of the Girl Scouts. And the next time one of those kids comes up to you with the mints, blame it on Lou Hoover, because she was the sponsor of the first sale of Girl Scout cookies. I might also point out 10 cents a box. They're now $2.50. She was very interested in helping people, and she found a fascinating way to do it. In, I believe it was 1926, Mr. Hoover had given his wife $1 million. He had done very, very well in his mining practice, and he said to her one day, "Lou, here is $1 million. Do with it as you wish, and I hope someday my husband will make the same offer to me." And he said, "I wish no accounting. Go ahead and do it. Enjoy yourself." Mrs. Hoover decided, as the depression began to worsen, that she was going to try to help people with the money that came to her. The money that was available to her. She would have her secretaries investigate claims that came to the White House asking for financial assistance, and if she found that they were meritorious, if these people were deserving, she arranged for them to receive money through various organizations. No one supposedly ever found out that she was really the philanthropist in this whole little project. Now, some people did find out, and I was told by the director of the Hoover Library that when she died in 1945, a number of people wrote to President Hoover, who was then living at the Waldorf Astoria in New York, to say, "Where's my check?" Aside from that, though, she really did have a rather withdrawn public approach to the public. She did become the first lady to use radio. In 1929, she was on a national radio hookup for the first time, and 8 of her 15 speeches were devoted to women's role in the Depression. She was a strong advocate of what Pat Nixon would later, many years, call volunteerism, women helping others to try to deal with the very terrible Depression. The next woman who I include in this category might be someone you know of. Her name is Jacqueline Kennedy. She is probably still one of the most famous women in the world. You still can't check out of a supermarket without seeing her face on one of the newspapers. She came into the White House in 1961, and she said, "My project will be to refurbish the White House." There has been some question as to whether it was really her idea. Some people seem to think that Jack Kennedy came up with the idea of the project to keep her busy and to keep her out of the way, and I want to tell you that's not true. There is a cartoon which was in the New Yorker during the 1960 election, and in it two women are talking, and one says to the other, "Of course I'm voting for Nixon, but I'd really love to see what Jackie would do at the White House." At any rate, Mrs. Kennedy made this a national priority. She let everyone know that this was what she was going to do. Because of her, today the White House is officially designated as a museum. The White House now has a curator, a historian. There was a book that she published with Lonel Aikman of National Geographic at the end of the Restoration called The Living White House. And I want to mention it because it's probably in its millionth printing by this point. But it sold for $1 initially, and within 3 years, it had paid for the total cost of the refurbishment of the White House. That's how successful it was. On February 14th, 1962, Mrs. Kennedy used the media, and the Kennedys used the media very well anyway, but she went on to three television stations, and she gave a guided tour of the White House. I was just recently given a tape. I hadn't seen the tape in a number of years, and I have to tell you, it still holds up very nicely. It's a fascinating tour of the White House. Unfortunately, as well as Mrs. Kennedy did with her restoration project and encouraging interest in the arts, she had some trouble with the less sublime aspects of being First Lady. Because to be First Lady means that you welcome Miss America to the White House and the brownies and anyone else who should come through the portals of the Executive Mansion. One of my favorite anecdotes about Mrs. Kennedy has to do with the fact that one day she was invited to a Senate wives' breakfast, and she was asked to bring a recipe, as everyone else was. And I guess that didn't sit too well with her, because she was enraged by the whole idea of having to do this. She thought it was a little bit silly. And she had her chef give her his most advanced concoction. Then she handed the recipe to her secretary and had her leave out one ingredient. So she could be a little nasty. I found from my research that she used the media very well. She would call them in on issues that were important to her, the White House restoration, culture, dance, theater, but she would push them away on other things. And she really did run hot and cold in her attitudes towards the press. She was the first First Lady to appoint a press secretary. And she appointed a young woman, Pamela Turner, who was 22 years old. Helen Thomas of United Press International said, "Pamela Turner has about as much business being a press secretary as I have directing the space agency." Ms. Turner felt that her job was to protect the First Lady from the press. And if you look back at the things written about Mrs. Kennedy, you'll see that Ms. Turner was successful and her press relations were not particularly productive. I can forgive Mrs. Kennedy a lot of the negative things that have been said about her, because I remember her behavior the weekend of November 22nd, 1963, very clearly. And I think she carried herself with a grace and dignity which helped this country through President Kennedy's assassination. The last of the women that I would place in the category of emerging spokeswomen was Pat Nixon. And I thought that Mrs. Nixon had a great deal of potential as First Lady. She came into the White House and said, "My project is going to be volunteerism. I want every American to be a volunteer, to give of his or her time to help the blind, to help the elderly, to help the hearing impaired," and on and on. The project never really got going until late in the first Nixon administration, when Mrs. Nixon was beginning to travel and give some speeches. She was seeing the press out of town, and then there was something called Watergate. And that was the beginning of the end of the project, and that was unfortunate. In the closing days of the Nixon administration, she was perhaps one of the few people who told her husband not to resign. She maintained his innocence. I feel of all the first ladies that I dealt with that I know the least about her. Her papers are not available for research. Perhaps you're familiar with her book, Pat Nixon, The Untold Story. It was written by her daughter Julie with materials that I would give a great deal to see. But we don't expect them to be available for quite a long time. The last group of women that I included in my study I called the independent advocate and political surrogates. And of course, if I'm following my chronology, I would start first with Eleanor Roosevelt, but I'm not going to. I'm going to save her for the end, and I do have a reason for doing that, and I'll get to it in a moment. This group of women probably probably almost came as close to what the traditional definition of rhetoric is, and that is using all the available means of persuasion. These women in this group used the media, press conferences, they wrote, they spoke, they traveled, and they attracted the national spotlight wherever they went. And because I'm not going to start with Eleanor Roosevelt, I will start with Lady Bird Johnson, who I was also very fortunate to meet in the course of my research. Mrs. Johnson is a graduate of the University of Texas with a degree in journalism. There is a story, though it's never been confirmed, that she intentionally did her best to graduate her high school class number two so that she wouldn't have to be valedictorian and give a speech. In 1934, she married Lyndon Johnson, who at that time was the secretary to a congressman, and she says in her own book, White House Diary, that thus began the Lady Bird Improvement Program. He pushed her, she said, to do many of the things that she did. She took a course in public speaking because of him. She learned about various parts of the country, industry, because of her husband. And when she came to the White House in 1963, she was well prepared for the task. The day after the Kennedy assassination, she said to the press, "I feel as though I am on the stage for a role I never rehearsed." But if there was such a thing, and if there is such a thing as being prepared for First Lady, Mrs. Johnson was. She came into the White House and said, "My interest is the environment. My project is beautification." I want to tell you that when I interviewed her, she said, "If I'd known that it was going to be such a big project, I would have never called it beautification. I've always thought the name was a little silly, but it was the best we could think of at that time." Her stated goal was initially to beautify the city of Washington, D.C., to plant flowers, to plant trees, and at the time, many people thought that that was a little bit frivolous because there was a lot of unrest in the city of Washington. Kay Graham, the publisher of the Washington Post, said she had some grave feelings about the whole thing, but she said, "Now, today, if you go through Washington and you observe the cherry trees and everything, you see how successful Lady Bird was. Enjoy the aesthetic parts of the environment." The White House actually lost count of how many trees and flowers Mrs. Johnson planted. She was all over the country. She opened national parks, a national seashore. She devoted about 60% of her speeches, of her 164 speeches, to that particular pursuit, to beautification. It didn't stop there. She was also interested in her husband's poverty program. She was a strong advocate of that. She went to Head Start classrooms where children were being taught some of the basic things that they would need to succeed in school. So she was interested in everything. She earned the title of the sales lady for the Great Society, but again, her role went well beyond this. She was acknowledged as one of the few people who could tell Lyndon Johnson to shut up and he would listen. She was considered one of his advisors. She had the most effect on him in regards to education and the environment. One of, I think, her most impressive accomplishments, though, took place between October 6th and 9th, 1964, when she got on a train and took a trip through Dixie during the 1964 presidential campaign. She made, I think it's 48 speeches in those 4 days. And I spent time with Liz Carpenter, who was her press secretary, and I said, "Do you think it was a successful trip?" And she said, "Well, you tell me." It was at the height of the Civil Rights Act. It had just been passed. There was a lot of anger in the South, and we didn't know whether the president was going to carry any of those states. He ended up carrying 5. So we thought that that was a pretty successful trip. Another woman that I would place in this particular, under this particular heading, is someone who, again, I had access to, and that was Betty Ford. And I would have to characterize Betty Ford as one of the most down-to-earth, nice people I've ever had the pleasure to meet. When I met her, I had my tape recorder on, and we were speaking, and she said some negative things about Rosalynn Carter. And I said, "Mrs. Ford, would you like me to turn off the tape recorder?" And she said, "Oh, no, I'd say these things to Rosalynn's face." And that really very much characterized Betty Ford. This was a woman who had raised 4 children essentially by herself because her husband was gone as many as 200 days a year, out speaking for Republican candidates and other members of his party. She told me, and she wrote about this in her book as well, she didn't believe that Mr. Nixon was guilty. She said, however, I started to get nervous when I saw pickets marching around the White House in the beginning of August of 1974 that said, pick out your curtains, Betty. And she said, shortly thereafter, of course, we went to the White House. 28 days after entering the White House, it was found that she had breast cancer and that she needed a radical mastectomy. She was already being given credit for being candid, but I think perhaps this was really when she established herself as someone who was forthright and honest. And she said, I felt if I had it, other people had it, and if I didn't say anything, the lives of these other women would be gone. Therefore, she went public. She spoke about her cancer operation whenever she could, and a number of her 100 speeches were devoted to the topic of cancer and what could be done to raise funds for the American Cancer Society. Just as a little aside, the American Cancer Society reported that in the weeks after Betty Ford's mastectomy, the requests for breast examinations and mammography rose by 2,000%. She did not really have time for a sustained project in the White House. So instead, Mrs. Ford became involved in a number of causes. And the most prominent cause was the Equal Rights Amendment. She said, I'm in favor of it. It's the right thing to do. And that's the way I feel about it. And she got on the telephone and she would call legislators in states where it was up for a vote. Now, this concerned the White House because they didn't know whether it was Mrs. Ford stepping on a state issue or whether it was a national issue, and it was finally clarified that it was a national issue, so she could participate in it. And she was calling all over the country, and Phyllis Schlafly and a number of other more conservative women took issue with Mrs. Ford's stand, and the pickets now parading in front of the White House had pickets which read, "Get off the phone, Betty." So she was touching a nerve. On August 10th, 1975, a year after the Fords had entered the White House, Mrs. Ford took really an unprecedented step of her own and decided that she would appear on the television program 60 Minutes with Morley Safer. And I mention it because it really is a landmark in some ways. If you ever have a chance to see it repeated, I suggest that you watch it. And rather than watching Mrs. Ford, watch Morley Safer, because he changes colors as the interview progresses. Now, if you didn't see it or if you don't recall, Mr. Safer began by saying to Mrs. Ford, Mrs. Ford, how do you feel about the recent abortion decision? And Mrs. Ford said, oh, I think it was a great decision. Takes abortion out of the backwoods and into the hospitals. And Morley Safer sort of shakes his head and says, oh, okay. Mrs. Ford, what do you think about the possibility of a woman on the Supreme Court? And Mrs. Ford said, oh, I think it's a wonderful idea. I lobby the president about it all the time. Morley Safer is now starting to turn white. And he said, oh, that's very good. What do you think about marijuana legalization? And she said, well, I'm sure my children have tried it, you know. And by this point, the poor man is staring at the floor. He does not know what to do. And then came the clincher, and he said, Mrs. Ford, tell me, what would you do if Susan Ford came home and said to you, Mother, I'm having an affair? And Mrs. Ford, ever the forthright lady, said, well, I would want to counsel her on it. I'd want to meet the young man. I'd like to know whether it was, and she caught herself and suddenly realized the implication of some of the statements she had made. And she said, well, Susan is pretty young to start affairs. The correspondence that came to the White House in response to this is absolutely awful. I have read a good deal of it. At least initially, the response was 8-1 against Mrs. Ford, and some of it is really awful. There were death threats. There were terrible things. Many people said that she had lost that person's support for the president with her statements. To his eternal credit, President Ford joked about it. He met the press the morning after the interview had appeared on television, and he said, well, when I watched Betty on television last night, I decided that she had lost me 10 million votes. When I read about it in the press this morning, I raised the estimate to 20 million. But he never said to her, you can't talk, you can't speak out. He never muzzled her she disagreed with him in public on a number of issues when he signed the proclamation for International Women's Year. He said to her, "Betty, would you like to say something?" And she said, "Yes, I'd like to say you've come a long way, Mr. President." We know that she advised him on many, many decisions. She told me in the interview that I had to her that she was never sure exactly to what extent she did influence her husband's decision making. But she said, "I know that when he went back to the Oval Office, he did take my thoughts and my opinions into consideration. And sometimes I heard those things later in speeches." Another of these rather active women is Rosalynn Carter, and I understand that perhaps some of you were fortunate to hear her. I find her, as I was telling Mr. Thompson earlier, to be the consummate politician. She was a Navy wife, a very young Navy wife. She had to return to Plains, Georgia against her will because her husband had to take over his father's peanut business in 1955 or 56. And she grew with her husband, and her partnership with her husband began and matured over those many years. One of my favorite stories about Mrs. Carter has to do with the 1970 gubernatorial election. It happened that one afternoon, Mr. Carter was speaking to a group, and Mrs. Carter had finished her particular speaking duties elsewhere, and she was standing in the back of the room. And when her husband finished, he was shaking hands with the people in the room, and she got in line to shake hands with him. And all of a sudden, she was face to face with him, and she shook hands with him, and he smiled at her, and she said, "Mr. Carter, I'd like to know what you're going to do for the mentally ill if you are elected governor." And he said, "We are going to have the best mental health system in the country, and you are going to chair it." Talk about throwing down the gauntlet. During her time as First Lady of Georgia, Mrs. Carter was intimately involved in various activities with the mentally ill, the mentally retarded of the state of Georgia, and she was not a titular head of that mental health committee. She worked in a mental hospital a number of days a week. She was out speaking with people who dealt with the problem on a daily basis, doctors, relatives of those who suffered. And indeed, Georgia did have a major overhaul of its mental health system before the Carters left the State House in Atlanta. In December of 1974, her husband announced that he was going to run for president. And Jimmy Hu was born. Mrs. Carter took to the road, and along with a few friends, she barnstormed the country, spreading the word that her husband really was the man for the job in 1976. Of course, he was successful. As a campaigner, I find her to be almost unmatched. She's not afraid to take on the serious issues. She's not afraid either to tell you that her husband is a capable man. In the White House, mental health became the top item on her agenda. She reorganized the Office of First Lady. As I was doing my research out at the Ford Library, I found a whole report that had to do with the reorganization of the First Lady's office. And she wanted to make it a structure that would be able to accommodate a really an activist First Lady. She was the first First Lady to attend cabinet meetings, which really annoyed a lot of people and made a number of other people applaud her action. She had serious working lunches with her husband once a week, and she was sent on a very serious high-level diplomatic mission to South America. Probably, Mrs. Carter was much more upset and bitter about her husband's loss in the 1980 election than her husband was, because she felt that he was doing the right thing, and she felt that he deserved another chance to continue what he was doing in Washington. Let me quickly talk about Nancy Reagan. She does not quite belong in the activist category. I called her in my book a First Lady in Transition because I felt that she had spanned all three of the categories that I set up. She had started as an inactive First Lady. As a matter of fact, she had said early on in press interviews that the First Lady that she most admired was Jacqueline Kennedy, so that gave people some idea of where she was going. And she probably came into the White House with the worst public relations of any First Lady ever. You might remember that there was a little to-do about Mrs. Reagan asking the Carters to move out of the White House early so that she could redecorate the family quarters. The story was never confirmed or denied, really, by either side. So cynic that I am, I suspect that it's true. There was also the matter of the fact that she said that she kept a gun next to her bedside when her husband traveled. That didn't play too well in the press. And of course, then there was the whole episode of her $250,000, give or take a few thousand dollars, wardrobe for the inauguration. Once in the White House, though, after the assassination attempt, which she said was the worst thing she had ever had to live through, she became involved in a drug program which eventually took that phrase, which I'm sure all of us know by heart now, just say no, and it became a very effective campaign. Whether you like her or not, I believe that you have to give her credit for having transformed herself as a first lady. And we talk very frequently about the fact that a man can grow in the job. And I think Mrs. Reagan grew in the job. I was very disappointed to see the kind of book that she wrote that had to do with her years in the White House. It is called My Turn. And one of my less charitable friends said it should have been subtitled My Turn to Get Even. She takes on everyone who ever had anything nasty to say about the Reagans, and I think that ultimately that will not play well on her evaluation on the First Lady Exchange. Barbara Bush, the jury is still out. I frankly thought that she would do a lot more with her literacy project. She hasn't traveled quite as much as was expected. However, she has not been completely well. She does suffer from Bright's disease. She does have a problem with her eyes, and I would hope that she will be more active in the months ahead. Let me finish my remarks by talking about Eleanor Roosevelt. I've left her for last because, as was pointed out in a wonderful series of essays on Mrs. Roosevelt, which came out a few years ago, there is almost no discussion of First Lady that does not begin since Eleanor Roosevelt, because Eleanor Roosevelt, of course, Eleanor Roosevelt. But she really did establish many of the yardsticks by which past, present, and future First Ladies will be measured. Aside from the fact that she advocated every cause that seemed to her right, I just want to give you another interesting yardstick. Beginning with December 31st, 1935, and up until a few weeks before her death in 1962, she produced the column My Day, a 400-word essay of what she was doing. During her time in the White House, she wrote 9 books. She gave probably, this is just an estimate on my part, well over 2,000 speeches during her time in the White House. And the most incredible thing to me as a teacher of public speaking is that most of them were given extemporaneously, which means that she spoke from notes. There were not complete texts. She had no speech writer, so I find that alone just an unbelievable accomplishment. Her correspondence with government departments, with her friends, was legion. And, of course, this was just separate from everything else that she did in the White House. She literally was the president's eyes and ears, as I'm sure you know, and that's probably one of the most hackneyed phrases that has come up regarding her. But I'd like to share one perspective with you that came to me from Helen Thomas, who was with United Press, and said to me, she had come to Washington in 1943, and she said, I came to the White House the first time as a young reporter, and she said, there were wheelchair ramps all over. And she said, the press never reported it. We would today, but we didn't then. And she said, I mention it to you because I want you to know how truly crippled he really was. It was not possible for him to get around. That's why she did what she did. I mentioned earlier, and I'm sure you're familiar with the fact, that she really did advocate almost everything that came down the pike. She wouldn't take on a cause frivolously, but if she thought that it would help people, she would do it. She used the yardstick, I think, of how can it help, in order to pick the things that she became interested in. She was out front early on the issue of civil rights. She opposed lynchings. She supported an anti-lynching law. She was out front on the issue of women. Something that surprised me early on was that she opposed the Equal Rights Amendment and continued to oppose it until a few months before her death. And she said that she opposed it because she felt that poor women Any women, most women, needed the protection of the federal government so that they would be entitled to equal housing and equal wages, and that was the basis for her opposition. She was out front on children. She was in favor of reforming the court system. She was continuously interested in the causes of war and how to try to deal with it. She was out front on trying to get refugees out of Europe. She tried to save I believe that she really did use every available means of persuasion that was open to her, and she probably was the first first lady to develop an identity separate from that of her husband. And even though the words Eleanor and I echoed through the Roosevelt administration, everyone knew that besides being Mrs. Franklin D. Roosevelt, she was Eleanor Roosevelt. My work has led me to a few conclusions, and I just very quickly like to share them with you. First of all, a first lady's age, her state of health, her family obligations will always have some effect on the way in which she will conduct herself as first lady. Anytime we've had an activist first lady, one who I would have put in that last category, it seems that we have a president who is more sympathetic to the interests of women, and ultimately he ends up appointing more women to high-level offices in his administration than others who are less interested. The First Lady rarely reflects the time at which she is in the White House, but rather reflects the time of her upbringing. I also found it interesting that the more active a first lady, almost across the board, the more likely she is to have a sympathetic press. And there's a reason for it. If the reporters have something to write about, they'll still extend some plaudits to the first lady in the form of positive coverage. There are some partisan differences between Republican and Democratic women, and I told Betty Ford when I met her that she had loused up that category for me, and she said, yeah, I guess I'm not your typical Republican woman, am I? And I said, no, I suppose not. It is almost impossible for a first lady today to remain incommunicado in the White House as Mrs. Truman did. You really have to have some project, but it has to be appropriately quote-unquote feminine. You cannot cross over too quickly or too forcefully into the area of public policy, or you risk criticism of the president. In 1953, Mrs. Roosevelt was interviewed by Edward R. Murrow, and she told him, and this will be my one quote that I'll read verbatim. She said, "You have to accept whatever comes, and the only important thing is that you meet it with courage and with the best you have to give." I think that we've been exceptionally fortunate in this country because every one of those women, certainly those I studied and those who came before, have given the best that they have to give. Thank you very much. I picked up something along the way, and I just wanted to share it to you. It says, I'm voting for Betty's husband. I really love it.
Dr. Gooten has three children, I think, including one in the terrible teens. Who among us who have had children has not said, I told him or her that yesterday? Dr. Gooten and all the rest of you should know that it was just a little over 10 years ago that Jim Rowe, who knew as much about politics, I think, as anybody who's ever been in this room, was sitting at this end of the table telling us about the Roosevelt presidency, and a young lady at the opposite end of the table, beloved now as Felicia Rogan, asked him, well, what about the First Lady? And he didn't have much to say. A little more than 10 years later, Dr. Gooten, we're finally getting around to Mrs. Rogan's question. So I think she ought to have the right to ask the first question if she wants to.
Well, I must applaud you. I think you've done fabulous research, and in fact, you must be a fabulous communicator because you rarely use your notes. I think you did a wonderful job and very exciting delivery to all of us.
Thank you.
We've heard many speakers, but I think you brought each one very alive to us. My only question would be, you examine these women on the basis of their roles as complements to their husband or as adjuncts to their husband. Did you ever look at their roles as their successful roles as mothers to their children? You never mentioned it in any way.
I investigated it because it certainly came along with everything else that I was doing. I didn't discuss it in my book unless it had an impact on how the First Lady functioned, and it did from time to time. But of all the areas, I would have to say, honestly, that probably merited less of my attention. It's an area I'd like to become more, I'd like to do a little more investigation of.
Next question, yes.
I noticed that you didn't mention Nancy Reagan's close relationship with astrologer Joan Quigley, who was on the television this morning.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if you had noticed how many other presidents' wives had brought such people to the White House. You mentioned the clairvoyance with the Florence
right.
Harding.
Right.
Were there any others, or did you?
As far as I know, it was only Mrs. Reagan and Mrs. Harding. That was just an oversight on my part, too, with Mrs. Quigley. But, no, as far as I know, it was only Mrs. Harding. And she had also been seeing clairvoyance and seeking their counsel before she arrived at the White House. As a matter of fact, she was supposedly told that if Harding ran for the presidency, he would never survive his term. And the day that he got the nomination, she was interviewed by the New York Times, and she said, "I can see but one word written over my husband's head if he is elected, and it is tragedy." So apparently she was influenced, and she was frightened, and she believed. I don't know. Maybe there are some who just don't know that.
Was she more outgoing before that?
She was called Plastic Pat somewhat before Watergate, and I think it had to do with the fact that the press always saw her as perfectly coiffed and dressed and with the painted-on smile. In reality, I think, too, the press knew that she hated campaigning. She had lost her zest for it after 1952, when her husband had to give the fund speech, the Checkers speech, where he said he hadn't accepted money. So I think that was the genesis of Plastic Pat. They all seem to gather those little names. Jacqueline Kennedy was called the Cleopatra of the Potomac. Rosalind Carter was called the Steel Magnolia. So, you know, they all picked them up.
Did you find that any of these women were affected by the ones that were affected by their husband's indiscretions? Did you see any effect on their lives and the way they presented themselves to the public?
Certainly in the case of Mrs. Roosevelt, I think that she decided that she would she became even more steadfast in her resolve to have a career of her own separate from her husband's. Mrs. Kennedy, I wish I could assess the effect of her husband's indiscretion. There are some people who have suggested that perhaps she did not know at the time. I find that hard to believe. I don't know quite how to answer that.
And Mrs. Eisenhower?
I don't know.
All the president's women.
Or all the president's indiscretions.
Arthur Stack.
A drinking problem?
Okay, I have two different responses to that. Factually, she did suffer from rheumatic fever as a child, and it left her with a weak heart. Plus, she suffered from Meniere's disease, so she had a balance problem, and very often that would make her appear to be somewhat unsteady. So perhaps that could account for the problems that people observe. On the other hand, I was told by someone that periodically she would visit Walter Reed to be treated for alcoholism. General Eisenhower had the question put to him in the 1952 presidential election. And if she didn't have a problem at that time, I believe that she had had one during his years in Europe, because he said, Mamie has sworn off drinking. I can't even remember the last time she took a drink. So,
Is there any evidence at all that the burden of this weighed heavily in terms of making personal developments and strikes of each of these women take the turn that they did, either positively or negatively? Did they respond to the to this kind of a behavior and either grow or wilt?
Do you mean their own personal
Their personal development in relationship to these indiscretions?
I think that they all gathered strength from it. Mm-hmm. You know, there's also the indiscretion so much, but there's almost a theme of tragedy that runs through almost every first lady, and I really haven't touched on it, but Grace Coolidge lost a son while they were in the White House. The Kennedys lost a son. As you go through, there are a number of first ladies who lost a parent early on and to a tragic death. And I've thought, too, that they've gathered strength from those problems, and they grew as a result of that as well.
Arthur Stock.
Why did Mrs. Hoover dislike Grace Coolidge?
Not Mrs. Hoover. Mrs. Hoover, as a matter of fact, had a rather warm friendship with Mrs. Hoover. It was Mrs. Harding.
Mrs. Harding, yes.
Okay. Well, Mrs. Harding was not well-liked by official Washington. She felt that she was looked down as a country bumpkin, and she didn't receive the approbation that she thought was due her. On one occasion, Alice Longworth went to visit her, and Mrs. Harding said she had a red book that had a list of the names of all of the people who had not been civil to she and Warren Harding since they had come to Washington. And these people should know that they were in her book. But she didn't, I believe she didn't like Mrs. Coolidge because Mrs. Coolidge was liked by everyone. She was a lovely woman. She was sought after for dinner parties, and I think it was just plain old-fashioned jealousy. She just didn't like her. That was that. And Mrs. Harding also did not care for Calvin Coolidge.
Alfred Buck.
Have you done any further extension in your studies of these women after their husbands have left the White House and they left the White House and come back to the real world? I think it's quite interesting to know what's happened to some of them. And of course, Mrs. Roosevelt again takes the lead because she developed her own career in a tremendous way and became a world statesman. Mm-hmm.
I haven't followed, well, I followed, but not that closely. Usually the incumbent draws my attention, and there's still so much material that's being opened, even on those that I've studied, that I end up going back to that. But that would be another area that would be interesting. Certainly no one has made the career for herself that Mrs. Roosevelt did. Though many of them, tend to stay rather active in various pursuits, though they pursue these really pretty much in public silence. Until very recently, I know Lady Bird Johnson was involved on the boards of a number of organizations. She was a regent of the University of Texas until a few years ago, and she was on the board of National Geographic, and she was the founder of the National Wildlife Flower Center. I mean, she's still going strong.
Mrs. Fishman.
One often hears about the isolation of the president. Do you have the feeling that the wives have reached this isolation, or were they just as isolated as the president?
I don't think, for the most part, that the wives have favored the isolation. If anything, I think that they have provided a window that the president needs on reality. Mrs. Roosevelt, Mrs. Johnson, Mrs. Ford all made it a practice to bring letters that were coming to the White House so that they could share with their husband what was really going on out there. Mrs. Roosevelt again, but Mrs. Carter too, I know, would try to invite wide circles of people to dinners so that the president could hear different opinions and could meet different people. So I think, if anything, they may be a link with reality that isn't there.
I was wondering, although you said you didn't pursue these women as much after they left the White House, but how much security do they have or require, such as Lady Bird Johnson and Jacqueline Kennedy and so forth, today? I mean, and how long does that last? Forever?
Forever. Unless they remarry. If Mrs. Johnson were to remarry today, that would be the end of her Secret Service protection. But, well, let's see. They've got to have at least a detachment of Secret Service. I would say at least three or maybe four agents who continue to stay with them. And they go and they check out whatever locations it is that the First Lady is planning to visit. There's one cute story that someone told me after one of my First Lady speeches to a group. After they left the White House, Mrs. Ford went to New York to see the musical A Chorus Line. And her Secret Service agents went in to check out the theater. And one of the things that they do is they take electronic equipment to search for bombs. Well, I don't know if you've seen A Chorus Line or if you know about it, but it, at least for a long time, it was the most technologically advanced musical, and all of the lighting cues were on computer, and the Secret Service wiped out everything, and there was no performance that night because they had no lighting. It's a great story, but she, you know, they really do continue to watch them very carefully. I know when I've had the opportunity to see them, I had to submit my Social Security number 2 days or 3 days in advance, and when I went out to see Mrs. Ford, they very nicely but very firmly had me dump out my purse and my briefcase, and they stopped short of a body search, but they feel that's their responsibility.
Did you request interviews with any of the women and you were turned down? Did you?
Yes.
Mrs. Kennedy?
Mrs. Kennedy turned me down nicely and firmly. She said, thanks, but no thanks. It was one of the great disappointments of my mother's life. I'm sorry. Seriously, Mrs. Kennedy sees no researchers, and that is regrettable. I know any number of historians or First Lady researchers who would give anything for a half an hour of her time. The Nixons see no one. Again, that's a loss. Mrs. Eisenhower, Mrs. Nixon is not well. She has had a number of strokes over the past few years. There was some concern for a while, too, that perhaps she was even more ill than she appeared. But it's interesting. Some of the First Ladies, ex-First Ladies, are, you know, more than interested in accommodating you, and others just are not. Mamie Eisenhower was even willing to see me at one point, but she became ill, and she passed away shortly thereafter. One of my uncharitable friends said there was a direct relationship there. I said, nice. But, no, they were wonderful. I still couldn't get... I was never able to get over the fact that when I met Mrs. Ford, she had a list of questions that I was going to ask her. And she said to me, well, I see what you're going to ask me here, but before we start, tell me about you. You know, she was just really very nice and very pleasant.
In your research, did you find that the press knew about Betty Ford's alcoholic or drug problem while they were still in the White House?
They had nothing definitive. They had suspicions. A number of people in the White House had the same suspicions. Sheila Weidenfeld, who was Mrs. Ford's press secretary, who was also gracious enough to give me an interview, said she noticed some very inconsistent behavior from time to time, and she wasn't able to get a straight answer from the White House physician. So it was noted. There were a few times during the 1976 presidential campaign where Mrs. Ford made terrific blunders. At one point, she called Mr. Carter President Carter when he was clearly not the elected president. So they had their suspicions, but there was nothing confirmed.
Would it make any... Bill Wimple can ask the last question unless someone else... But before that, would it make any sense ever to look at First Lady's parents? Maybe others knew Mr. Auchincloss, but I once got into a club in New York, and the two people who had nominated me, one I'm sure you probably knew, he's in your field, but Philip Jessup and Frank Alcho, and they couldn't be there. They had an annual dinner, and so Mr. Auchincloss was the host, and Bob knows, belonging to the same club, that you sit right next to the right hand of your host. And I tried for 45 minutes to engage him in conversation. And there was a little bit like Adam Ulam, the professor at Harvard, who hates teaching. And he's reportedly the only person who fell asleep during his own lecture. So I'd ask a question and he'd doze. And I, maybe some of the rest of you know. You know?
It was Jackie's stepfather.
They were right. Step, not the real father.
No, Olivier was
their
father.
Olivier, right. That's right. But would there be any point in looking back a generation? Or?
Certainly. It would give us, I think, another perspective and tell us a little bit more where they're coming from and the influences. I think one of the fascinating things, though, is that so many of these women have surmounted, or in some cases just exceeded, what you know they might have become. And they turned tragedy into some very positive things.
Final question, Bill West.
I was going to ask whether you might have to go back as far as Dolly Madison, but maybe Jackie Kennedy. You think of a first lady who really took to the part, lived it to the hill, basked in it, enjoyed it thoroughly. Didn't have problems about what she could say or people she could or couldn't see or anything like this. Didn't worry about those things. Just loved the part of first lady.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know if she really liked it quite that much. I think she reveled in some of the more public aspects of being first lady. As I had said, I think, Jacqueline Kennedy, she loved the entertaining. I think probably the best entertaining that Washington ever saw. Betty Ford again said to me, boy, that woman knew how to give a party. And I think that was true. I think that she reveled in that particular facet of being first lady, and certainly she enjoyed the White House renovation project and the things that she did with the arts and culture, but the more discreetly political demands of the job were not to her liking. I think she was distinctly uncomfortable with that.
So you don't have a candidate for that quality?
For someone who really embraced it?
Yeah.
Oh, dear. I would say Mrs. Ford came close, and even she was not 100% comfortable with it. She felt that always being in the public eye was exhausting, and I mean, she did have problems with alcohol and drugs, and she said that she felt that some of that was directly attributable to the scrutiny that she was always under, so I'm not sure.
Rosalynn Carter?
Yeah, Rosalynn Carter loved it, but I think and it's different there too, she loved the potential of what could be accomplished. I do not think that she ever really completely enjoyed the ceremonial aspects. I'm not sure that the entertaining was to her liking, but I would probably go along with you. She came close.
Mrs. Bush says she's having a ball. Lovely.
Well, there it is. There's the answer. She looks like she's having a good time. She does.
We can't thank you any better than Mrs. Rogan did, so I'd simply say that we've all thoroughly enjoyed your presentation
thank you
and learned
much.
A great deal from you.